Well, hello and welcome back to Failure Peace Theater. I am your amiable co-host, Tim, and joining me today is the hottest community manager on the internet, namely my sister.
Catherine, it's me.
And we're back after a bit of a hiatus, mostly because of quote-unquote big life things.
Yeah.
You had a little video game that you work on was released. And we're going to have to refer to this as like the AH period of our lives, the after Helldivers period, AHD. Yeah. That's what we'll call it. We're now in AHD time frame. But yeah, so your game Helldivers 2 released to the world.
Yeah.
And the world had a resounding hell yes.
They all bought it.
Everyone bought it. Everybody bought it. It is a wonderful game. It inspired me to rewatch Starship Troopers with my son this week. His first watch, my rewatch, to which we paused. This episode isn't about Starship Troopers, but we'll start here.
Aww.
when it got to the scene where they're going into to be recruited and they're given the oath, and then they go to the guy who's in the chair and he's like, "The mobile infantry made me the man I am today." And my son goes like, "Wait, are these the bad guys?" And I was like,
"Hey,
yes, you got it. You figured out what a lot of very adult bearded people on the internet are incapable of still figuring out to this day."
It's true.
That Starship Troopers is a satirical look at a fascist society born out of all of the Nazis that went into hiding post 1940. That's why they're white people living in Argentina with Argentinian names. Like that's it. they're all the children of Nazis.
It's bad.
It's bad. And all of the people who have non-Argentinian names like Radcheck, right? Just like an actual European name. That's the name that the dad, Johnny Rico's dad, goes, "Oh, what a weird name." Oh my God, that movie's genius. But Helldivers plays upon a lot of those same ideas, what with its super Earth and super democracy and
managed democracy. All of that.
Managed democracy.
Managed democracy.
Yes, your story Bible is robust and very fun. But yeah, so how's that been before we segue into this week's discussion?
Absolutely insane. I know that. I mean, we knew that this would land and that people would get it. We didn't know that quite so many people would fall in love with Helldivers. But we did, you know, we had high hopes, I thought. Blown out of the water. Everybody, like I said, everybody bought it. It's been crazy. I am the community lead person.
I was going to say community lead, I guess, is your title now.
More or less, yeah. Our Discord server, you know, our original projection was, an aspirational 20,000 members. We hit 500,000 on Friday. Thursday. Kind of mind-blowing there.
Now.
We have so many players. We have so many people talking about it. Like, it, I guess you could say that the game has in many ways gone viral.
Very much so.
We're all really happy. We're all really tired. Because it's really hard to kind of walk away from all of this as it's blowing up and people are getting so excited about it. Shout out to our back end team. They work harder than anyone I know.
Heck yeah. I have optimized database code in my past. I have tried to cut down
more people.
Database query code from, you know, I think the biggest file I ever worked with, which is nothing compared to what these guys are doing, was like 14,000 lines. And I had to get it down to way less than that. it's a challenge, man. That's not easy.
I feel like I've learned so much just from being in meetings with those, you know, big tech people. I still know nothing, But it's been really fascinating to see like how a live service game works behind the scenes. So I've played so many live service games, and I've always kind of been involved in live service game communities. But seeing it from this side, it makes me appreciate it so much more.
Oh, absolutely.
Because these are just really incredible people. All of our developers are incredible people, but certainly seeing how hard they work has been really remarkable.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm sure you have a unique window into that because, you know, you and I both, we were lifelong game players. We, you know, have had that be a part of our daily lives for decades now. So we're, you know, you came at it very much from that player perspective, and you've grown into this much more, I'll say, robust understanding and perspective of game design and development. And I've watched that happen, which has been really fun for me as the older brother that built you that first gaming PC back in 2001.
It was the year 2000. It was Christmas 2000.
Christmas 2000. That's
never
right.
Forget it.
Because I had built my computer the year before, and your computer was basically the slightly newer version of what I could get for my stuff. So, yes, very much so. So, exciting times. Like I said, I'll say publicly here on our podcast how proud I am of you and of all of the
choices
you've made and sacrifices you've made to get where you are right today in a beautiful apartment overlooking a lake or a river.
It is. It's
Sweden,
a lake. It's a lake.
It is a lake.
Okay. Big ass lake.
I knew you could walk across it. I knew that.
Yeah.
But anyway, just super cool, super fun to watch that develop. Super fun to watch my friend group get super hyper into this game as well, because it ticks a lot of boxes for the people I play video games with too. So that's been kind of fun. But I definitely need to play more. I need to get my level up so that I can get the good stratagems and use that to spread managed democracy throughout the galaxy against its enemies.
Oh, yeah. That's what we do.
Well, so this week we've returned with a sort of fun little film. So our mission here on Failure Peace Theater is to, you know, sort of return to films that maybe didn't get their due at the time for one reason or another, right? Maybe it was critically drubbed. Maybe it was financially unsuccessful. Maybe it was just straight up missed, which is where I think this film sits. I don't think anybody has ever heard of this movie, because I consider myself a pretty big fan of the found footage genre.
Same.
This kind of is getting into almost like a fake documentary territory as well, which a lot of found footage films use that as a framework to sort of get the job done, a storytelling, you know, sort of frame that they can use. But I mean, like, as a person who really enjoys that genre of horror film, especially, I'd never heard of this. It sort of came up. I listened to a lot of different movie podcasts and YouTube shows. And this one was just sort of offhandedly mentioned because it's getting an updated Blu-ray release that's going to come out here in the States at some point. I think maybe Vinegar Syndrome is doing it. And so it was just kind of offhandedly mentioned, like, oh yeah, The Tunnel. And I was like, I've never heard of The Tunnel. What's that? And so I went and found it. And once again, it is available on Tubi.
Tubi.
Just go watch it on Tubi right now. You know, so in lieu of its release, which, you know, should be coming hopefully for the next few months, I need to look at this specific date. You can actually go and just check it out in its entirety there. So yeah, this is absolutely a found footage horror film. It is Australian, right? It was released in the United States in one theater. So I don't think they really expected it to do much business. Maybe it was one of those, we do a limited release, and then if there seems to be interest, we'll expand it. And then that didn't really happen. But yeah, so what did you think of The Tunnel? What are your first impressions once you checked it out?
I really enjoyed it. I love found footage. I don't know. I mean, sometimes it can go wrong. Sometimes I don't love it.
Sure.
But for the most part, I do. And I really enjoyed this. It didn't overstay its welcome. It didn't try to do too much.
Yes.
You know, reflecting back on another movie that we did a podcast on, As Above, So Below.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I love that
Definitely
movie.
Definitely some of those vibes here. Yeah.
But I do feel like at times it did a bit too much.
Yeah, I'd say the last third of that movie where it gets, I'll go ahead and say, overtly supernatural. It shows a bit too much. It plays its hand a bit too hard. It might have been more interesting if things had stayed a bit more restrained. Because the first half of that movie, when they're just like crawling through those tunnels, terrifying.
But it's one of those things where usually where a found footage movie falls apart for me is if in the final act it feels like it has to escalate to some crescendo moment, like it has to have a big moment or a big reveal, because that's pretty typical of regular horror movies.
Exactly. Yeah. But that is the pattern that we do see there.
But I prefer found footage to go subtle. Just end it. You don't mm-hmm. have to end it quite like Blair Witch. You don't have to just do the hard cut to credits. You can right, yeah. do a little bit more than that. But I vastly prefer the found footage movies that try their hand at subtlety, as subtle as a horror movie can get, I guess.
Yeah, and this one does have its big moments. Like it does try to have like a couple of pretty significant moments or scenes. But the one of the conceits I like about this, and we'll talk about it more when we sort of break down the film itself, is that the documentary portions of this movie are actually with the people who went through it.
Yes.
So they established very early on that there were survivors,
yeah.
which is not normally how this goes.
You notice right away the people who are missing.
Right.
Like, oh, yeah, they have not been interviewed. I think that means they died.
And I like that. That's a fairly good way to sort of establish that there are going to be stakes here. Because for a long time in this movie, I think if you're just kind of floating along with it, maybe not trying to see how it's building to those big moments, you might get the impression that this is there's a pretty low impact on the individuals involved here. Like, oh, they're just getting spooked or they're getting scared. But then when you start thinking about like, oh, wait, they're talking to these people, but not these people. Why, oh. you know, why not? And then it's like, oh, okay. That's why not. I also like that they're very careful in their documentary framing. The two people who are sort of sharing about the experience, one is the camera guy, right? So the camera guy, you know, survives. Spoilers, I guess. Sorry. Like, again, I think it's told pretty early. And then there's sort of the reporter, because this the setup for this, I also think, is pretty good. We've talked about what I generally refer to as the sinister setup, which is they sort of make excuses for why these people are putting themselves in this situation. Right. Because the situation, they realize pretty early on that it's dangerous and that they're not going to have any support or going to have any help while they go do this. And much like in the film Sinister, where we get a sort of complete understanding of why the character is choosing to stay in the house where all these people died, it sort of lays the groundwork and says, like, here is why these people are making this very bad choice. And it's because they're journalists and the primary reporter is sort of, she's gotten into some trouble. Some of her stories have been called into question. And so she's kind of desperate for a win, I guess, is the way it is. It's like a journalistic win. She needs something to hang her hat on or her career is in jeopardy, yeah. kind of thing. And so I think that, again, having just that little bit of, oh, here's our motivating factor for why we want to be in this experience is really cool. But so the experience itself, again, this is set in Australia, and they say it's like 2007 is when everything was supposedly happening. And I don't remember there being like an Australian water crisis, but I presume that there was. I imagine they're trying to sort of touch upon something legitimate at the time.
Either that or it's a very believable scenario.
Sure. Just something that people, you know, from Australia, who presumably was the initial target market for this movie, would be like, oh, yeah, that makes sense. And so the idea was there was this plan to use these underground tunnel systems, which were apparently built for the war, right? World War II, and now have collected water to pull the water out of those tunnels, process it, and then use that to help alleviate these water issues that they were having. And then the program just dies and disappears and nobody mentions it again. And so this reporter wants to go down into these tunnels, which apparently have now become a haven for the homeless. There's a short video early in the movie that shows these like teenagers down there, and they go to investigate something. And then, you know, presumably only like one of them makes it back out again. And so she wants to go down there to investigate this phenomenon and discover why is it that the government abandoned this project, I guess, is the setup. And I think it's a pretty good one. I mean, found footage horror movies don't need to have really complicated setups, you know? And this one might even be more complicated than some, but it feels very believable. The character motivations seem pretty honest. I bought most of it. There was no point where I was like, they're doing the thing where they do this so that, you know, the like Paranormal Activity, my biggest issue with that movie, the first one at least, is, you know, his whole, like, why does he want to film everything, right? Like, why did he buy the camera? And it's just, it's all very contrived and, you know, just like, well, we have to justify why these cameras are running all the time. And some of them did it better. I think the third Paranormal Activity, or maybe even just the second, was there were a bunch of break-ins in the neighborhood. So they had security cameras set up or something. Like, even something like that helps me kind of get over that hump. But this one I thought was a pretty good premise. I don't know about you.
But I really liked the conceit of how they had the cameras with them in this movie and sort of the setup for how this, well, like, you know, the documentary, but like how they get into this situation. It felt very natural to me.
Yeah. Like, this is a very natural premise. It's the sort of, again, as I said, like the sinister effect where the filmmakers have created a conceit that justifies why these people are taking this risk, even when it is ill-advised. And so, you know, we do get a couple of scenes. I do like the variety of the types of footage that this film is throwing at us. Again, I think there's something to be said for, I mean, the Blair Witch Project really established most of this stuff, right? Where they had like the big camera that they were filming on, and then they had the DV cameras, and then eventually it's just DV camera because they run out of film.
That's very real. I mean,
yeah,
that is, like, if pragmatic. You're making a documentary, if you're doing some kind of news piece, or if you're doing any kind of filming, you will have multiple cameras. You'll have different kinds of cameras for different purposes. That feels very normal. But this one also had the really interesting addition of microphones.
Yes.
Which I thought added a little something extra. Just
yes,
to some of the horror scenes. That was really cool.
Yeah, they established very quickly that there's a sound guy, right? Because, I mean, this is a news crew. And yes, a lot of news crews operate simply with the, you know, microphones mounted to the cameras. But if you're going to film, you know, theoretically a variety segment where you need, you know, good audio, you need good environmental audio, it would make sense that they'd have a sound person with them just getting those recordings. And then later in the film, those audio only, you know, recordings become increasingly important.
Yeah.
So we're getting that. We're getting a lot of security camera footage, you know, which again is something that, you know, in American society, we're not as familiar with sort of the idea of, you know, security cameras being everywhere. But in a lot of other cultures, especially Australia and Europe, you know, it's really normal for there to be street cams and all kinds of stuff. And so we get, you know, cameras inside their offices that we get to see them going around, that they use those to sort of set up a lot of the initial tension between the reporter and like her producer, which, you know, we also find out that the reporter and the producer have had a relationship in the past, which complicates things because, you know, he's trying to help her in ways that like a typical or more traditional producer wouldn't necessarily be as willing to do. So he's willing to kind of break the rules a bit to help her because, you know, they had this relationship in the past. And So, I mean, there's some other like interesting, normal, just well thought out conceits to make sure that this all kind of builds and we understand how it happened. Right. Which I think is something that a lot of modern horror, that's why we're getting so much horror that's like set in the past. You know, they don't want to deal with cell phones and, you know, legal ramifications. They just want to put all that away so they can focus on the horror part. But this movie very smartly says, like, no, we're not going to put all that away. But we just want you to understand why we subverted all of that stuff to go do this. And I think that that's one of the reasons that makes this, it's one of the things that makes this very watchable and pretty compelling, I think. I also like that we see so many flubs and mistakes, like even when they're, you know, doing like their actual documentary setups about the tunnel in advance, because they talk to like a homeless guy or something, right? And they're talking to this dude and he basically like, you know, gives away the game that there's something down there kind of thing. And we get to see like them getting zoomed in and like, you know, their focus is all off and all that kind of stuff. And again, that just kind of builds to the cinema verite kind of component that they're working towards, which is really cool. So yeah, I guess, you know, overall, I think this is a really great found footage horror film. It's 90 minutes and out, which, you know, I always appreciate. It doesn't overstay its welcome.
I think with found footage, that should be like a rule of making a found footage film is to make it short. Because I think, I think that any movie that's tried to go over this length is where they fall apart.
it's so hard to sustain the conceit and sustain tension for much longer than that, right? Because it's just such a, it's a different way of processing film information. You know, this one I think could have gone longer because it does have those extended documentary interviews, you know, so we could have spent more time there or had other people come in and give their insights. Like I was really expecting towards the end, because the movie opens with a 911, well, whatever the call in Australia would be, and our equivalent in America would be a 911 call, requesting help at a train station. You know, so I would have thought maybe, you know, you try and get some of the police officials or something. But again, in the conceit of this film, none of those people would have commented on what happened. Like nobody's going to come forward and be like, oh yeah, this is what took place. So. It all kind of falls together. It all works really well. You know, and I do like that they took their time in the setup. You know, this is pretty much a straight three-act movie in that it's 30 minutes, 30 minutes, 30 minutes, mm-hmm. which I think is kind of cool. But they pretty much enter the tunnel around minute 30 of this 90-minute film. And then they spend about 30 minutes wandering around and then, you know, 30 minutes in the climax kind of thing. Maybe a little bit less in the climax because it does kind of barrel through the last little bit. But yeah, I think it's clever. I think it's really well done and very well produced. I'm sort of shocked that because the directing team that put this together, they didn't really have not done a lot else, surprisingly enough.
Well, for my thoughts, I guess, I wish that this movie had gotten a wider release because I feel like it deserves a bigger audience. And I wonder overall if this isn't like a consequence of the movie being Australian. I don't know that like Australian movies get much of an audience in the US. I don't know if they're given much of an audience, like unless it's something that has Crocodile Dundee attached to the title. Typically we just don't make much space for those movies. And that's a shame because this movie is really good. And I wish that more people would have seen it and hopefully, you know, maybe through the power of Tubi, they can.
Yes. Tubi is the answer.
Tubi or I not agree. Tubi.
Well, I mean, I think the phenomenon that you're touching upon here, and you're very correct, is that, you know, Australia and you know, well, every country in the world really has its own sort of robust film industry, or at least many do. But, you know, they're all overshadowed by the American film industry, which has, you know, the most cash on hand, I would presume, in a lot of cases, etc. And so Australia, I think, has been producing and exporting incredible films for quite some time. You know, like obviously the Babadook comes to mind, but that was kind of the rare exception where that movie came out and was tremendously popular here. So yeah, I mean, the Australian film industry has had some pretty significant exports, you know, as I mentioned, the Babadook being one that came over here and found, you know, pretty large scale success in the United States as well. But that's, you know, less common. If anything, what tends to happen is Australian successes, you know, like your Margot Robbie's and your Chris Hemsworth's, you know, they just get absorbed into our system and start working here rather than continuing to sort of produce films in Australia. You know, and this is an example of one that, you know, it's very low budget. It was like $130,000 budget, which, you know, again, pretty significantly low for the grand scheme of things. And obviously didn't have like a large scale distribution plan or something to really get it to the American market. But it's one that has obviously persisted in terms of its, you know, word of mouth. I know Bloody Disgusting, did a article about like great mockumentaries and, you know, this was on there kind of thing, which I think is pretty telling.
I did want to call out like one movie that I thought of just because of the documentary framing and how it was framed. It kind of reminded me of Europa Report.
Okay. Yeah, absolutely.
I don't know if you remember that one.
Just yeah, the one with the kind of science fiction-y
documentary that was surrounding it. I thought that was a really nice touch. And it kind of reminded me of that. Yeah, I just thought that was kind of an interesting, like similar, I mean, obviously the Europa Report is way more science fiction. But the way that they used the frame narrative of the documentary was really similar. And that was another thing about this that kind of set it apart, because like most found footage movies, they either go all found footage where they're like, we found these tapes in the woods and everybody's dead.
Right.
Or yeah. they may just, you know, set it up to where it's just people with a camera and it's the, my boyfriend has a camera and he's just filming everything we do.
The paranormal activity. Yeah.
I really like that this actually tried to put it together. Like this is how you would present this almost like a, you know, like a Fox special over this terrible thing that happened or something.
Yeah, it has a legitimacy to it that I think works in its favor. It feels and is shot very specifically like sort of traditional documentary footage. I think it's a lot of it has to do with those interview segments. I think yeah. That's what really sells it. And it's a bold choice, again, to have characters from the story you're telling sort of be verifiably okay. But it does sort of air in... It sort of gives it this legitimacy that I think a lot of found footage movies strive for and then are never quite able to achieve. You know, they choose to go for legitimacy with, oh, the camera's handheld and, you know, it's shot really badly, you know, all of that kind of stuff. And this one tries to make it feel more like, okay, this is the footage we recovered from a news crew who was trying to get the job done. And then it just kind of went south. I think that helps it a tremendous amount. Similar to how the conceit of them being students in Blair Witch supports, you know, sort of like why they're terrible.
This film actually would have sucked if they had finished it.
Yeah, like it was never going to be something anyone would want to watch. It would be another terrible student film documentary. And so it all just kind of hangs together. You know, it's the Big Lebowski of found footage film. It's the rug that holds the room together. Right. And sometimes that's all you need in a horror film. You just need your audience to not be asking the kinds of questions that'll take them out of the narrative experience. And this movie does a good job of sort of building that. So an overall recommendation on The Tunnel before we kind of break down some scenes and parts, etc.
Yes, huge recommend from me.
Cool. Well, if my, you know, tone hasn't given the indicator, me too. I found this very impressive. It felt a little bit to me, and what I think, if we're looking at the direct line of found footage horror films, this feels a lot like Wreck to me, which also had the conceit of it being a reporter in a group, you know, a news team going into this, you know, strange environment. And this, you know, in the case of Wreck, it's a building that's under quarantine. You know, Wreck was remade in the US as Quarantine with that girl from Dexter or whatever. You know, it's an inferior version. Wreck is much more terrifying, but I think it was sort of, you know, this is sort of following along from that Wreck branch of found footage horror.
Yeah.
And in a really solid way.
I always forget about that movie. I don't know why. It just doesn't, it doesn't stick in my mind enough. I enjoyed it, but yeah, I always forget.
And it, you know, and it swelled very quickly into its own, franchise. You know, there were several of those, and even they even made a sequel to the US remake of it. But yeah, those movies were solid. And you know, those directors did go on to do a few more things, but really not much. It's sort of incredible to me that a lot of the found footage filmmakers don't ever really find much success in other film, right? I've always kind of been surprised by that, because it's almost like they don't trust them to make a more traditional movie, because they've made these, you know, found footage, you know, which to me is a much more sort of complicated enterprise, you know, just putting the camera down and having it be the invisible observer instead of an active participant in what's going on seems like the easier choice. But, you know, the original Blair Witch directors, well, they've done some producing and things like that. They've never really done much else. I know Eduardo Sanchez has directed some TV. He did a segment on that VHS series that was pretty good. But VHS is found footage series, so that would make sense. You know, it's just kind of interesting how it doesn't always translate to success elsewhere. You know, just kind of strange.
Yeah.
But yeah. So I think this, for me, I mean, especially given its budget, is, you know, sort of right in line with, you know, Wreck and, you know, even Paranormal Activity, which I know we bag on quite a bit, but, you know, Paranormal Activity works, and it's a very functional found footage horror film. Again, it doesn't do a great job at the conceit of why they're filming everything, you know.
I don't hate Paranormal Activity.
No.
Because Paranormal Activity gave us the Paranormal Activity riff tracks, which is one of the funniest things I've ever heard in my life. And that is one that I have rewatched multiple times because it is so good.
Yeah.
I can't be too mad that exists. And frankly, those movies like this, found footage horror movies, they have really lightweight plots, and that makes them communal movie watching activities. You go with your friends to the theater, or you hang out on a couch and you watch this movie and you kind of half pay attention to it. And then when something scary happens, you can all turn your attention to the television and enjoy. So I can't, right. I don't know, even though I'm not a huge fan of Paranormal Activity, I still just can't find it in me to hate it, because it's like, you know, it's doing what it set out to do.
Yeah. And it was done so, you know, relatively inexpensively. Oren Peli, you know, was able to create and reinvigorate a phenomenon, you know, in found footage that it had faded away. You know, there had certainly been examples like Wreck out there, but, you know, nobody really cared at that point about found footage. And then it kind of brought all of that back. And I'm happy for that, because it's a genre that I enjoy.
Same.
But yeah, so a recommend from both of us. This is definitely one worth seeking out, especially for free on Tubi. If that's where your cinematic desires lie. But we will, let's go ahead and kind of break this down, talk about a few of our favorite scenes and some of the elements that I think work best. We've kind of already hinted at really the first act of the film, which is the setup, right? It's a news team. The reporter's a bit dodgy. She's kind of on her last legs in terms of being a reporter. And so she's looking for that big story that's going to make and break her career. And we kind of get to see just how, I guess, kind of desperate she is. There's that scene with her chasing like a parliamentary guy down the street, trying to get him to comment. And he's just like waving her off. And, you know, it's just, there's a lot of, I don't know if the scenes are meant to engender sympathy, but they're certainly meant to help us understand that she's pretty desperate for a win, you know?
Yeah.
And that kind of sets her character up pretty well, because she makes some pretty shit decisions later in this. Like, she does some real shitty things to get this done. And, you know, we kind of understand why, like, but at the same time, it sort of helps us know, again, sort of what the stakes are and why she's choosing to do these things. So really the film kicks off around the 30 minute mark when they actually sort of go down into the tunnels. And I guess our major players are the reporter, the producer, the one that she's, you know, had the relationship with, the camera guy who we know is still alive via the documentary segments, and a sound guy. Was his name Nacho or something?
What was his name? It was like a funny nickname.
It was like a nickname. I kind of feel stupid because I don't have it queued up, but
shit. I can't remember. It was his real name was Jim. Because yes, I remember when they brought that up, I was like, why the fuck do you call him the stupid nickname? And then Pete was the one of the ones who doesn't make it. We'll just be upfront about that. You know, Pete doesn't make it.
He doesn't make it.
Tangles. His nickname was Tangles.
Tangles. Of course. How could I
forget Tangles? Jim Tangles. Big Jim Tangles.
Big Jim Tangles out on the ranch. They're headed down into this thing. Yeah, so the reporter is Natasha. Peter's the producer. Steven's the camera guy. And Tangles is the audio engineer, the microphone man. And so they head down into this thing and you know, they have a lot of trouble even sort of getting where they need to go, which I liked that, you know, she had done all this research, but she wasn't even ultimately sure of exactly how to get down into these tunnels to begin with. And, you know, most of those scenes are shared through security camera footage and things like that, which is kind of cool as well. We do have a bit of a Blair Witch setup as well. In that everybody has kind of different cameras. We've got the nice camera. We've got the cheap camera. You know, like these guys were students of this type of film, I think. Does that impression you got? Like they really had kind of researched how these things had been done. That's at least the impression I got.
So yeah, they used the security cameras to show entering the tunnel, which I don't know. I like when movies do that. I thought that was a really nice touch. But then when they get inside the tunnels, what is it about like underground spaces that just absolutely freaks me out? Like I just can't, I can't handle it. Where I'm like, this is the scariest thing I've ever seen in my entire life. Because these are massive tunnels. Yeah. They're like massive subway tunnels, kind of. That's what they are, but it's not entirely because they start out really huge. And then they start to immediately get closed in. And it seems like they start off in these really big open spaces. And then as they start to turn corners and sort of move around, things get smaller and smaller and more cramped sort of as they move forward in them, to where I don't even know what these tunnels are.
Yeah, they certainly seem like they've been connected or hooked up to the subway system, which plays into sort of the climax of the film.
But like this is a terrifying sprawl of just weird spaces that like, why are these here? What are these doing for anybody?
Yeah. Initially, they look like, you know, almost like water aquifers, you know, so maybe again, that's playing into the idea of them going down to find all these hidden repositories of water, you know, or whatever. But yeah, eventually they just turn into, you know. We've all watched that movie where a character is running down a thin hallway with pipes on the sides, you know, and there's like, you know, scattered lighting across the top, maybe bare bulbs, that kind of thing. We've all seen those movies and this one does that quite a bit. You know, we eventually get down to those, but it does seem like an interconnected sort of system of bunkers and, you know, a variety of other kinds of tunnels.
It's just always what you hope that is not underneath a city that you live in.
Right.
And no, a horror movie like will always tell you like, oh no, it's definitely down there. There's a bunch of tunnels and you've never seen them before, but they're there. Like, oh, okay. Cool.
Yeah. I mean, the main tunnel that they come to, which we see several times as they're like going in and leaving, is almost like, you know, an interior subway tunnel that's just abandoned, right? It's huge, it's arched, you know, it's 30 foot ceilings. You know, there is lighting, which I liked. There is quite a bit of tunnel lighting. They deal with sort of their lighting situation pretty much right at the start. Like, oh, we're going to use this camera's light and we're going to use these flashlights, but they're very mindful of batteries. Like, that's really a constant thing from the beginning, is that we only have like so much battery power. We've got to be careful and blah, 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 which I think was cool too. I do like that we still get the interspersed shots, like the nice shots set up with the good camera of the reporter, like walking into frame and out of frame. And, you know, like you can tell some of the footage that they're shooting is like the stuff that it's the stuff that a news group would plan to shoot, you know?
Right.
And I like that they keep that conceit and they keep that footage in here. And usually when they show those, it's the camera guy who's doing his documentary stuff, sort of, you know, sharing what their ideas were, kind of thing. So, you know, all of that is working really well to establish everything's normal. You know, hey, we're just a news crew. We're doing our jobs. No big deal. And then, you know, things take a pretty quick turn, because I guess one of the things they've come down here to find is that they know there's a large homeless population that live in these tunnels. And so they're trying to like connect with those people, find them. There's this whole segment that they shoot like really nicely lit and framed of, you know, some kind of like sleeping hovel where a bunch of homeless people have been, you know, and so it's very much like, oh, we're journalists, we're serious journalists. And then I guess it's right after that that they kind of go down the first little ladder in the corner,
which is like immediately. No, I would not do this for any career, journalism career, certainly not a community manager for a video game career. Like, I'm not going down in any tunnels. I'm not squeezing down any little fucking ladders. That's crazy.
Yeah. And they're little, like it is teeny tiny where they have to go. But again, you mentioned earlier that it's the audio guy that gets to provide a bunch of the scares early on. And it's because he keeps hearing things in his microphones.
It is. And, you know,
nobody else can hear them. And that, man, that's,
I just got to say, I really like Steve and Tangles. I don't know why. I just really liked these characters. I liked the rapport that they have. It kind of reminds me of, you know, all horror movies kind of have that shit talking crew. Like Alien had that with Yaphet Kotto and Harry Dean Stanton, like the shit talkers, the guys who are just, you know, just trying to do their jobs. But
tell me
then,
about my bonus, man.
Exactly. Exactly.
Tell me about my bonus. Yeah.
And you get that vibe from Steve and Tangles. And then inevitably that makes it even more terrifying when they become kind of the early targets of our first big scares. And I love audio scares. I mentioned the microphones, that I love that they use microphones in this, because I think that that's something that horror movies can lose track of really easily. That shit sounds scary, and we're more afraid of sounds and things that we can't see, but maybe hear, than things that we can see. So I really liked that they kind of sold the horror early on with the sound guy. I think that was great.
Yeah, totally. I think that rapport between Steve and Tangles, because they more than anybody else are kind of done with all of this. Like, they know about the relationship. They know that they know the stakes of what's going on, and they're also well aware that this whole job is kind of a joke, and nobody, you know, again, they're the voice of reason, the like, nobody should be down here doing this. This is kind of silly, kind of thing, which I think works super well. So let's delve into the movie itself, right? So the tunnel, as we said, is a, you know, it's a Blair Witch style documentary, but this one makes some really cool choices, right? So we actually, the film opens with, a 911 call or whatever the equivalent of that is in Australia.
Yeah, I don't know.
It's not, It's not 911.
Are they 999 there, or are they, I don't know.
That would make sense, you know, just because then it's just one number you have to press multiple times. But yeah, so we see a call, and it is a woman who is very distraught and very upset, saying that they need help at a subway tunnel. And then the person's trying to respond, and it doesn't go anywhere. Then we get a credit sequence, which, you know, I don't know was necessary. What did you think of the credit sequence?
The credit sequence kind of took me aback, because when you recommended the movie, you were like, oh, it's found footage. And then it has this very, like, kind of bog standard credit sequence that you would see on the front of, I don't know, like a James Patterson adaptation from the late 90s. So
it reminded me of that show Person of Interest. You remember that? The one with Jim Caviezel?
Yes.
And the guy from Lost?
That's what it reminded me of.
Yeah.
That guy's nuts.
He took that very personally.
Even Jesus was like, hey, bro, calm down.
Yeah, he's like, whoa, you're an actor, dude. Calm down. I was kind of the same, you know, especially on rewatching it to kind of prep for the show. It definitely hit me as like, this is not something you generally see in a found footage film, because you're trying to keep the conceit rolling. But I guess what they're using it for, at least the impression I had, is to try and help you understand like the tunnel thing. Like what are these tunnels? Because they're kind of showing subway tunnels and kind of, you know, the history of them digging these out in the city in the past. You know, they're kind of doing these weird wipes, almost, you know, again, like documentary stuff, you know, like they're documentary techniques, but it's not something you generally see in found footage movies, right? Generally you get a title card at best, you know? So it was a little bit off-putting, at least I thought so. Not bad, you know, a lot of B-roll.
Yeah, it just, I don't know, it kind of surprised me, because it, you know, usually when you have like a found footage film, they go out of their way to remove the credits, especially if they have any kind of like framing piece, like this documentary thing. Usually movies will be like, nah, we don't need that. We want to keep it immersed in this thing. And this movie was like, no, we definitely need our little credits moments.
Right. And you know, again, it's all about sort of maintaining the fiction of it. And if they had leaned further into this is a documentary about this event, maybe it would have been more justified, because like you're viewing the credits on the documentary of the thing, but they didn't really do anything with that. You know, it's you know, that conceit is present, but they're not really sort of dinging it and saying like, this is why this is here. Because I really think, because, you know, after the credits, the movie goes into a fake, you know, news segment of a guy talking about the tunnel situation and everything that's happening. So it almost felt like the documentary, the Ken Burns style history of the tunnels being built, was a little unneeded, you know?
Yeah.
But anyway, so, you know, the conceit for the film, as we mentioned before, is that there's these tunnels underneath the city. There's this plan at one point to go into them, get the water out of those tunnels so that they can deal with this water crisis that they're supposedly having or something, which again, I don't know anything about New South Wales. I don't know if there was legit water crises in the 2010s.
I have no idea.
That seems possible or plausible at least. But then like this tunnel project gets abandoned, and that's what gets this reporter on the case, right? That's what brings her to it. But what I like very quickly is that the setup immediately gets sort of, I don't want to say complicated, but we start finding out that it's not just about like uncovering the secrets of these tunnels, that the people involved here all have kind of personal reasons for wanting to go down here and do this. And I've said it before, I call it the sinister effect. It is the act of justifying why your characters are putting themselves in this really stupid situation. And I really appreciate films that take a couple of seconds and try and think about a legitimate motivation for why people would do this, you know, and it, just as I appreciate the converse, right? The nope effect of a character saying like, oh, hell no, nope, not doing it, not happening. And then legitimately running away. I also appreciate that. Like, acknowledge, you know, that the things that are happening around you are terrible, and you need to either do something about it or acknowledge that, you know, you're just going to kind of stick it out for some reason. I like it when those movies do that. It's why I appreciated Nope, you know, as a project. you know, it was kind of a punchline or a joke in that movie that, I mean, but I'll never forget that scene where Daniel Kaluuya's in the truck and he's just like, nope, not doing it. Not getting out of the truck. It's not happening. You know, that kind of stuff really works for me. You know, because as a person who watches a lot of movies, as you are as well, it becomes really obvious when screenwriters and filmmakers just have not considered those things, right? The plot is being driven by the need that the plot needs to be driven. Like that's what's happening, you know, well, the plot needs to happen. So we're going to just do this. I mentioned in our pre-show that I'd seen Madame Web, and Madame Web has a lot of that. A lot of like, well, the plot needs to happen. So they're going to go to this diner. Why'd they go to that diner? Well, that's where the plot's happening.
That's where the plot is. Yeah.
We need them to go to the diner now, you know? So yeah, some very interesting stuff there. But so then we start getting, you know, what I think and what we mentioned before is kind of the thing that sets this found footage apart, which is the after event documentary portions, interview portions. Because this is something that I had never really seen in a found footage movie before, of interviews with the characters post event.
Yeah. Right? The only thing that came to mind was that Europa Report movie, but even that, there were no survivors. It was just people involved in this project then talking about the thing after it happened. But you didn't see the people who were in the movie in the documentary piece. So like,
right,
it is so immediately clear who lives and who dies.
Exactly. Which is choice.
Yeah.
That's
yeah. You know, going into it, like, oh, Pete's not going to make it. Now I'm sad, because it is kind of sad.
Yeah. Like it is. And I was really concerned at the beginning that, oh, like this is going to erode tension, right? Like the tension is going to be gone because we know who makes it. But I think it's a testament to the fact that tension does not come from knowing the ending of a thing. Tension comes from the filmmaking techniques on display. Yeah. And that's why I can still watch Aliens, you know, 30 years on, you know, for me anyway, and still be enthralled by that film. I know Hudson dies. Like, I know it. Like, I'm well aware of
that. But every time you think, like, maybe he could make it.
Maybe he could make it this time. Like, he's a resourceful dude, right? He knows. And yeah, it's just, it's a really, really interesting choice on their part to just sort of lay their hand out that early. And to a certain extent, I feel like it expresses how confident the filmmakers were in the premise and the horror that they knew they were going to generate, that they felt comfortable enough to be like, we're going to kind of give the game away about how this is going to go down. And, you know, I think it's kind of a baller move. I think it's a really cool choice. And what I've, you know, as I was thinking about this a lot, especially over this last week, it seems like, you know, the found footage movies that come out and they make a sensation, it's because they're doing something a little bit different with the formula, right? Like in thinking about something like Paranormal Activity's real, like, I don't want to say gift to the genre, but the thing that they did different were all the time-lapse sequences.
Yeah.
Right. Like setting the camera on a tripod and just letting it run and then like slowing it down as something big was going to happen. Right. Sort of like playing with your understanding of how film editing works to know that when things like slow back down to normal, this is when it gets intense. So, you know, pay attention.
And it's kind of supposed to give you that feeling like you're reviewing the footage with somebody.
Right.
Like that's what you would do. You would scrub through it and then you would stop when something interesting happens.
Yeah. So, I mean, it really does seem like there's, you know, the found footage films that have sort of left their mark on me, generally, it's because they are kind of pushing in some interesting way. I feel like the Blair Witch, the soft reboot, the legacy sequel that they tried to do back in like 2014. Was that Adam Wingard? I think it was. One of those mumblecore guys. You know, he was really trying to do that with like adding in drones and ear mounted cameras, you know, trying to enhance the ways in which you were seeing things. You know, that movie's not very good. I've watched it several times. It's not terrible. But it's just a little, it doesn't do enough with the Blair Witch conceit, and it gets way too supernatural. It shows too much. That's really its main problem, which this movie fortunately does not have. This movie does ride that fairly well, I think.
They don't show you anything in this movie because you can kind of tell they don't have the money to do that.
Right. If you don't get the money or you're going to rely on some big CG weird limbed monster, just don't.
Yeah.
Just don't. It's fine. Have some weird glowy eyes in the dark. You're all good. Right.
Works for me.
So, you know, as the film gets going, you know, we start to see, you know, the reasons why the journalist wants to go down in there. She's in a relationship or has had a relationship with her producer, which, you know, I mean, if you know anything about TV journalism, you basically have a producer and a journalist. They're paired up to actually make packages for a local news station. The producer is generally the one that sort of like makes the calls, gets the permits, and then the journalist is your on-screen talent who's doing the reporting. And then you have your tech crew general. I mean, nowadays it's usually just one camera guy. There's usually not a sound guy in most journalism crews that I'm aware of. But in this one, we get a camera guy and a sound guy who are going down with them so that they can film this documentary pieces.
Love them both. Steve and Tangles.
Great characters. Steve and Tangles.
I love it when a movie can make us feel like we're witnessing a friendship already in progress. Like, yeah. I just think that's really special. And a lot of horror movies fall flat, where they try to show us camaraderie between characters and then it just doesn't work. You can tell these people have never met before. But Steve and Tangles have like a bro thing that I really like. I really, really like those characters.
Yeah, I was really leery because like the first major scene, you know, before anything really gets going, is supposed to be like a birthday party for the producer. And they're all just getting together for like drinks after work. And, you know, initially as we were watching that scene, I was like, oh man, I hate it when they do this. And they're trying to like show people having a party and like, oh, this is somehow supposed to convince me that they're friends or whatever. And it rarely works.
Yeah.
Like those party scenes in movies for me are generally duds.
Yeah.
And that forced party interaction does nothing to convince me that these people know each other or like each other or have any kind of relationship outside of this film that smashed them together. But that party sequence at the beginning felt really natural, really off the cuff. Like if it wasn't fully improvised, then, you know, it felt like it was. It felt very natural. And I'm with you. Like that relationship, especially between Steve and Tangles, got established super fast. Worked great. I also like that the guy that played Tangles looks like the dude from Garage Days and Speed Racer. That actor.
Yeah.
I can never remember his name, but if you saw him, you would know him immediately. He was a pretty consistent Alex Proyas, you know, Entourage member. I know. We talked about Gods of Egypt on here, didn't we?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, poor Alex Proyas. We rewatched Dark City the other day. Showed that to the kids for the first time. And that shit still
so
holds
good.
Up. Holy
so
shit.
Good.
That movie's so good.
And now they're going to make they're releasing the new Crow movie. And it looks
new Crow,
bad.
It does.
Really bad.
I never wanted Machine Gun Kelly as the Crow. But that looks like what they're... I know it's not. I know it's Bill Skarsgård. And he's good. And he might be able to rescue the thing.
Mm.
But
I mean, he's very cute, but I don't know. I just...
The problem with the Crow... Sidebar. The problem with the Crow is that it is a property that is embedded in the late 80s and early 90s like an Alabama tick. And... It is really hard to extract that premise.
And you know what?
From heavy metal music of the early 90s.
Brandon
and Iggy
Lee
Pop.
And was so beautiful. Wow.
That, yes. Did you see that GIF that was going around earlier this week that apparently was like the last footage shot of him right before the shooting? And it was just him lighting a cigarette. And he was so fucking cool.
He was
holy
so cool.
Crap, dude.
He was so pretty. Wow.
And you know, if you go back and look at the James O'Barr original drawings, like, you know, he's supposed to be like a minstrel of death, right? I mean, he's that poofed out 80s hair, you know, the glam rocker. It's just, it's a very specific look that when you put the you know, the happy, sad face paint make, you know, paint on that face, it plays together. But, you know, visually, I don't think it's working for me. I haven't watched the trailer yet. I'm not interested in really watching it because I know it's going to be sad.
It started playing. I scrolled past it on social media and then it was happening and I didn't stop it. I should have stopped it, but I didn't. And I have regrets. I shouldn't have watched it. I just, you know, I know better. I know better than to watch that. And I did.
Well, I mean, we've talked before and many people have talked at length about Lightning in a Bottle projects. Blair Witch Project was one of those Lightning in a Bottle projects. Mm-hmm. People have tried to recreate that formula for years and they can't. Even this film, as good as I think it is, it's still not that.
No.
But the same with The Crow. They've taken many, many swings at The Crow. Generally, as
within that the process same franchise. Of like
holding on to licenses. Yeah. Oh, totally. Yeah. I mean, like the second one is tolerable.
But you should never describe a film as tolerable as a recommendation to see it.
like the thing that makes the second one work is that Vincent Perez, at the very least, has like a really great look as the Crow. Like they did the Iggy Pop vest with him in sort of like a different flair. But that film was assassinated by its color palette. It was that mid-90s, you know, everything is brown. It was bad, you know. What I used to be very angry at Blade 2 for being, and I'm still kind of angry. I like Guillermo del Toro a lot, but I don't. The color palette of Blade 2 is atrocious, and I hate it. The color palette of that movie should be red, not brown.
Right? That's fair.
It's a vampire movie. Make it red.
But blood turns brown when it dries.
But yeah, so I'm also very concerned, but.
I didn't mean to derail this talking about The Crow. But
no,
like
I'm glad we, because that was one I thought we would talk about before we got started, and I kind of forgot about it. But yes, I love The Crow. I hope James O'Barr got a really big check, so that he can continue just doing whatever he likes to do without interruption. Because that dude's had you talk about, what's that line? Have you seen The Holdovers yet?
Not yet.
Oh, Jesus.
That's on the list.
Paul Giamatti has a line in that. He said, "For most people, life is a hen house ladder, short and shitty." When I think about that line, I think about James O'Barr. Because he had a bad run of luck, man. And was able to somehow take a lot of that pain and misery and put it into something really amazing, called The Crow. But, anyway, so yes, we'll see. We'll see how The Crow comes down. But when they announced like the director and writing team, I was already like, oh, no.
I just don't like it. I don't like it. It's bad. You know, The Crow is one of those movies that was just really special. I mean, I've said these words on this podcast before. We've been doing this long enough that I've had a chance to talk about.
We've
The
cycled
Crow.
Around, yeah.
But that movie was really special, and
absolutely,
it almost didn't get released because of what happened, of course. But
totally,
we got it, and then you can't really recreate that. Like the everything that was surrounding that movie that happened as a result of that movie being made. You have this like incredible rising star with like Hollywood royalty. I mean, it was Bruce Lee's son. I just don't, there's no way to recapture that. And I'm just always floored that people think they can.
Yeah.
And why would you want to? Like, just make something else. Like, there's so many good goth, dark comics that you could turn into movies that we have not even touched yet.
Absolutely. Yeah, I'm with you 100% on that. And this is where the Stephen King maxim is important. The new thing does not do anything to the old thing.
Nope.
You can still go love the old thing and it's fine.
Loving the old thing right now. I love it.
But the main thing to take away is that at one time there was a director named Alex Proyas.
At one time.
He was amazing.
He was
And he
so
had
good.
A string of movies that were so good that it was like, impossible.
And nobody knows what happened to him, but he disappeared. Nope. and he was never seen again.
he made a movie with Will Smith, and then it was all downhill from there, which I think is going to be something a lot of people can say someday. Let's just say I hope that Gods of Egypt is not his last movie.
I mean,
I hope, but
how
we'll
can
see.
Such a great director have only made 7 movies?
I don't know. I don't know. But I will say this. The people who wrote Gods of Egypt also wrote Madam Web.
Fuck. Well, that explains a lot.
They just won't go away. They're like ball cancer. and I say that as people, because they also did the Lost in Space show on Netflix, which is great. Like, I love the Lost in Space show on Netflix. Such a great show. Really fun watch. So, like, they're capable. Like, it must be one of those things where they turn in the script and then, like, some studio executive just starts, like, cutting pieces out and being like, oh, we'll put this part over here and then we'll put this part over. Like, it's got to be one of those things. Like, they can't have been working in Hollywood for that long and just produced nothing but crap. I just don't understand. But anyway.
Tunnel movie.
To the tunnel. Yes. So what we quickly get is a little bit of palace intrigue, right? So as we mentioned earlier, the journalist, her motivation for going down into this, what is admittedly got to be a fairly dangerous enterprise. They're going down into these abandoned tunnels. We get a couple of shots from earlier of like a bunch of teenagers down there filming themselves. And then like, apparently some of them go missing. So like there's danger here. And so why are they going to do this? What is their point? And we find out that the journalist is sort of on her last legs at the studio, right? Like she has not produced any quality work for a while. Nobody's taking her seriously.
She's got this scandal like that her boss is having sex with her. And maybe that's why she's still right there. And so that's haunting her a bit. That like nobody takes me seriously. They just think I'm his beard.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And so it's a real, you know, it's a believable motivation for a character to want to take this kind of swing. If you feel like, you know, nobody's really taking you seriously, so you've got to go big. And everybody kind of knows it, which I like everybody's sort of like, yeah,
one
well,
shot, huh?
That's what we're going to do, I guess then. And so I really do like the mixture here too. The thing that this, you know, another thing that this particular found footage film, you know, tries to integrate is a lot of like, you know, security camera footage from inside the studio. We get a lot of, you know, footage from, you know, down in the subway tunnels. Like they're using some of that environmental footage, like they've gone and collated all that together. And then, you know, the action that's being described in whatever interview we're seeing about these conflicts and problems, you know, it might just be a dude in a room in the corner and you just see a little glimpse of them standing there, you know, having it out with somebody in an office or whatever. And I really liked that, you know, that we just kind of see this natural life stuff happening. I can imagine it would have been fairly difficult to coordinate all of that and sort of make that all look natural, but all of that plays really well. Yeah. And I think it helps to ground this pretty early on, because without those scenes, you really just have the interviews and then you have, you know, some of the faux documentary shots of them, you know, out on the street trying to get interview footage with politicians or whatever. Like that's kind of all that's there without that security camera stuff. So I kind of like that, but it also justifies like nobody would have had a camera on in the office to see these things, you know, without that, which I think is kind of neat. So, you know, we get some other faffing about, if I can be honest. And then we kind of build, you know, this movie's almost a perfect 3-act structure. It's 30-30-30, which I think is kind of interesting. And so the last big thing for me, and I don't know if you would feel differently about it, is they do an interview with like a homeless guy from the tunnels, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, starts off fine. And he's kind of just like, they're asking him questions, trying to get him to talk about his experiences. And then he just goes off the handle, right? Just like freaking out, screaming, like trying to throw himself out of the room.
It triggers something. Really know what,
right. And they don't really know what to do with that, which I think is kind of interesting. You know, like if it certainly doesn't give them enough pause. It should have given them pause to be like, maybe this
well,
is bad.
They kind of write it off that he's emotionally disturbed and it's probably due to things that happened because of his homelessness.
Right.
So it's almost like they're weirded out by it, but not for the reasons that we know as an audience that they should be. Like, as an audience, right. you're sitting there like, oh, shit, right. some oh, bad's bad. In the tunnel. But they're all just like, wow, this guy has really been through it. That sucks.
What a weirdo. Yeah, you know. You know, and then we get the standard. I mean, it seems like you can't have one of these movies now without, like, the gear check, where we see all of the array of gear that they're taking. But I like that, you know, like, we got it in Blair Witch, as they were telling us that there are two different cameras, two different styles. And this one, kind of, they show the night vision camera, which becomes very important. You know, the sound equipment and what he's taking with him to record. And then, like, the big camera that Steven will be using to sort of get their main footage. Like, it's very good. It establishes kind of the tools that they're going to have at their disposal in the tunnel. And, you know, again, I think this is a pretty standard part of found footage movies now. It seems like they all kind of have that. But this one felt natural. It's all just kind of shot inside of their little cubicle in the office, which is kind of cool. But the way that it's shot, the thing that I wanted to point out about it, apart from just the scene itself, is that Rick is doing most of the shooting. The producer guy, he's holding the night vision camera. And so he's kind of, like, sitting in a chair looking up at everybody. And then the journalist shows up, and just the angle on her face that they sort of build out of that scenario, like, she feels she's on the outside of the cubicle while everybody else is on the inside, kind of joking around and having a good time. And she just feels so isolated from everyone. Like, she is not a part of this in-group in the way that she thinks she is. And yeah. It was just a nice little subtle, well, not even really subtle filmmaking thing, but it really does help to establish the stakes of this, that she is not a part of this team, but she's going to be the one leading them into this scenario and situation, which sets up a lot of the conflicts for later in the film, which is cool. So then, really, I guess we can just jump to them getting to the tunnels, which they really go at length to show that it's hard to get down into this place, right? Like, they try to go to the subway first. And then, like, they get immediately turned away, and a guy's like, no, you never go down there. Do not go down there. Like, you know, you get the standard, you know, guy standing at the gates being like, nope, nope, nope. Like, this is bad. You know, which, again, tension building, you know, you kind of need that in movies like this. If it's super easy to get to this place, then why haven't a ton of people done it, kind of thing? And then, you know, they're cutting chains and squeezing their way through gates and doing all kinds of illegal shit to get down into these tunnels. And I've got to admit, man, these tunnels are creepy as F. Like, they
trigger all the things in me that upset me the most. Like, tight, small corridors, tiny ladders that lead down into pits of darkness. Like, it's just, these are so scary. It's perfect, though. Like, it's absolutely what I want out of this movie that's called The Tunnel.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the title let us know what we were in for, but yeah. You and I both have issues with, you know, sort of caving and tunnel scenarios and situations. Our early days of
I know I'm going to be upset by a movie called The Tunnel, but I can't stop.
Yeah. Like, I'm not smart enough to stop. Experiencing it. I've seen The Descent. I know where it goes. I know where this goes. Speaking of another filmmaker that has lost his ways, Neil Marshall, holy crap. He put a movie out last year with his, apparently married a model or something, and now they make movies together. And so she's like the star of all of his movies, and they made one of, like, fighting some kind of monster in the desert, and she's a pilot or something, and it was real bad. Anyway, okay. So yeah, they move down into the tunnels, you know, and they seem well equipped at first, which I think is important, because you have to feel that standard confidence that, like, these people have all the tools that they need to navigate this and survive this. And, you know, then things just kind of go south from there pretty quick. The second act of this film is mostly exploration as they sort of delve deeper. And I just, again, I love the aesthetic of these tunnels. You know, we have talked about, as above, so below, before and you know, being embedded in those catacomb-like tunnels. This is a very different kind of tunnel, but it still evokes the same feelings.
Yeah.
You know, they're industrial, they're brutalist, concrete walls. You know, there's no light, there's no warmth. It's just very, very stark and scary.
And I really like how this starts off as a big open space. Like they start off in these like huge open subway tunnel type places. And then it just slowly gets smaller and tighter and more twisting and winding. And you really, you're disoriented. Like by the, I guess 2/3 through this movie, you have no idea where they are. You have no idea how far they've gone. You kind of like there are a couple of landmarks, but you have no idea how they're navigating any of this. And I love that.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's tiny rooms. It's steel doors. Everything's rusted. Everything's destroyed. As you mentioned, the aforementioned tiny ladders descending into pits of darkness, which is really where the movie turns, I think. When they go down that ladder into that lower area, there's at least for me, there's a ratcheting of tension in that film, because that's where, because again, doing a lot with the technology in this smartly, having the sound guy with like the advanced microphones, he starts hearing shit, right? And it's shit that we can't hear, and it's shit that the rest of them can't hear.
That's so perfect, because a sound guy would hear things that you can't hear. A sound guy would be the one who's like, the fuck is going on?
Yeah.
This is weird. This is weird. Like, he's the one who gets weird first.
Right. He's the first one that's like, something is off. Something is wrong. But of course, he's just like, you know, he's just, what is it, Knuckles? What's his name? Sorry, I keep forgetting.
Tangles.
He's just Tangles, right? He's like the fun guy, right? Like, Tangles is super upbeat and super excited and just kind of happy to be hanging out, you know, with everybody. And so when he turns, like, you know, in any movie, when your like comedic character gets scared, that's a significant ratcheting of your tension.
I mean, we already brought up Hudson.
Yeah, absolutely.
When Hudson freaks out, we're freaking out with him.
Right. He's the voice of the audience and very purposefully giving voice to those tensions so that they can deal with them. But then I guess like the next significant moment, they wind up in this tiny room with this weird, like, black triangle on the wall, and is it a bell or a vent cover? It's some kind of like a geometric object, and she starts hitting it with a hammer. You know, I guess they call it a bell in the film.
Yeah, it's some kind of landmark. I didn't really understand what it was.
Yeah, because there's like, they try to talk about like what these tunnels were for and how they were used. And, you know, like, I feel those details are good world building, but it's, you know, it's nothing huge. But the main thing is that they're making a lot of noise. And so Tangles has to like sort of, he wants to get a good recording of the sound of the bell, but he can't inside the room because it's just too much feedback. So again, for a very legitimate reason, he's going to like take some of his equipment and string it a couple rooms away and set up a microphone so that he can get a better tone for the recording. And this is like where things, you know, take their turn, because then no more Tangles. Like, he's not there anymore. And that's where, you know, they do the thing where they have the journalist listen to the audio that he recorded in the bell room for the first time. And we just see her reaction, and it's like, oh damn, like that was bad. And it's just like that for me, that might be the one thing in this movie that just is chef's kiss perfect. Yeah. Like I loved that conceit.
I like when movies do that.
The sound guy, you know, like the sound is telling the story. That is so great. You know, people talk a lot about modern directors. You know, one thing about like Christopher Nolan is, say what you want about him, Christopher Nolan is a problematic guy from a sound perspective. I think he's super obsessed with sound in his films. I think he's really, really involved in that process. And sometimes he has very bad decisions. Like, I will never let him live down the Bane voice. The Bane voice was such a terrible idea.
Yeah.
And they had to fix it so many times in post, like after the release of that thing, to try and make it understandable.
And it still sounds bad.
It still sounds terrible. You know, like it's just a terrible choice. But it's because he's trying desperately to sort of like create this soundscape. He does the same thing in Oppenheimer. Oppenheimer has a very, very aggressive, bombastic, LOL, soundscape on purpose. You know, like Ludwig Göransson's score is doing exactly what I know Christopher Nolan wanted it to do. But I appreciate the filmmaker that at the very least is very concerned with how the sound interacts with the image, right? Because that's what film is. It's sound and picture, right? It's both. And so the directors who are obsessed only with getting great shots, I think, you know, are holding themselves back in some ways. In this film, to play with sound in that way, in this very low budget, very, very sort of scaled back way, to use sound to sort of be the first major scare is really cool. Like it's a neat thing. And I like the way it's executed, because when he disappears and that audio, you know, cue happens, like everybody freaks. And they are all like desperate to try and figure out what's going on. And I loved it. Like the tension just immediately ratchets up. You know, like I also like here, because Steven's camera work, like again, Steven is manning the big camera, right? The real camera. So the shoulder mounted unit. And pretty much everything shot with the shoulder mounted unit up until that moment is super stable, super steady, you know, just like everything's fine. Like he's being a cameraman.
Yeah.
But after Tangles disappears, that gets tossed out the window. Like he is running, he is losing shots, there's glitches. It was really neat. Like, you know, you could see, because Steven, for the most part, is not in the faux documentary footage, because he's on the camera. Like you see him occasionally, but he's mostly in the interview segments talking over this footage, because he's the one carrying the camera. So there's like, they're using the camera movements itself to show you how Steven is feeling. And that's really cool, because as a cameraman, he would never do these kinds of things unless he was freaked out. And that's good. I like that, because again, the conceit of these movies that people would keep filming and keep recording when this bad shit happens, you've got to do something with that. You've got to help me. Cause like we rewatched Cloverfield a few months ago. It was on Apple TV Plus for free or something. And I was like, I wonder if this holds up. It doesn't. It's not a great film. It's got good moments. The tunnel scene when all the alien babies appear, it's still good. It still works. But I'll just, that scene when frickin' TJ Miller is running down the street and he's got the wherewithal to turn around and film the monster fighting the soldiers, I'm like, no. Just no.
That movie was
never
stupid.
Happened. It's not a great movie. Again. 10 Cloverfield Lane.
That
was a good movie. The Cloverfield Paradox. That was not a good movie. But 10 Cloverfield Lane. That's a pretty good one. I like that. I like that guy. He's good. he made that Prey movie. That one's good too.
Oh, yeah.
Danny Trachtenberg. Okay. So anyway, so the tunnel, you know, now they are trying to find Tangles, right? Their reason to go deeper into the facility, which they had already been talking. Am I remembering this right? They'd already been talking about going back. They're like, okay, we got everything we need. Like we're done. Let's get out of here. But then Tangles disappears and now they have to go deeper, right? Now they have to try and find him. So things just get even more, you know, like state of disrepair. Now we're getting brick walls, right? The concrete walls are gone. Now it's brick walls, dirt floors. You know, it's just, it keeps escalating. And everybody's freaking out and they don't know what to do. So we get a lot of panic. And then I guess the next big feature is the blood room. That's what I called it. I don't know if you had a different term for it.
I think that's apt.
But so they find like a room that's had a corrugated grate. Do they hear Tangles screaming? Is that what gets them going
like
in this direction?
And, yeah. And it's the classic Blair Witch setup where like they're being lured. Tangles been dead. Like we all know, the audience knows that Tangles is dead. Tangles is not coming back.
Nope.
But you don't blame them for being kind of suckered by whatever is in the tunnel. But it is luring them.
Yeah, it's Josh on the fourth night or whatever, when he's out in the woods, just screaming for help kind of thing.
Yeah.
And so they kind of go towards that sound and they just find a room literally covered in blood. Like it bathroom scene, it part one bathroom scene covered in blood, with a single solitary, like school chair sitting in the middle of the room, also doused in blood. Very creepy, very spooky, shot. Well, the lighting gets a lot lower here. They're like struggling to maintain battery, you know? So like I think she even lost her big flashlight at some point in that sequence. So like the lighting conditions get a lot darker. Everything feels like it's just starting to compress. And then we get our first interaction with the creature, if you will. And namely that when they were getting into the room, there was a thing I had to move out of the way. So the producer guy sets his camera down on the floor and then something moves it. And we see the thing moving it from perspective. And man,
that was good.
This was good. This is a smart choice. Like for a found footage movie to let the creature film the people for a second and sort of have that perspective on them. Phenomenal. Just super well done. And then you get that scare and that like, oh damn. And then you get to watch them watching it so that they realize that they were being filmed by something that they don't know. So just bravo stuff here. Like really, this is clever. You know, one of the movies that we talked about, I guess, was Wreck. And of course, Wreck got an American remake called Quarantine, which was a lesser film, but, you know, it had a bigger budget and you know, whatnot. This is one of those movies that I think this would be worth that. I think it would be worth sort of revisiting this concept, whether it was the same tunnel or whether it's set in Australia or whatever, but just the sequences of this, the ideas of how this is assembled, the moments that we're getting, I think this could work gangbusters for a larger audience. I really do. Cause it's a solid horror premise. Like it works. But so they do get a glimpse of the creature. They freeze frame it and it's indecipherable. Like you can't see anything, which I think is kind of awesome. Great. Yeah.
I don't want to see what lives in the tunnel. I want to think about it. And I want to be afraid of it, but I don't ever want to see it because then it won't be scary anymore.
That's right. It's that classic B movie horror. You don't show the monster till the third reel. And, you know, and when you do, you got to be careful about it because it goes from being an esoteric, you know, terrifying thing to a guy in a rubber suit. And that's what you want to avoid. So then we get a nice diversion, right? Because, okay, so we've built to an incredible moment of tension. And then they find like a grating or something that leads up to one of the, it's not a subway station. It's like on a bridge or something. But it's like, you know, they're close to getting to the surface, but you know, not close enough kind of thing. Yeah. Like they are still trapped and there's like a, you know, 6-inch hole leading to the surface that nobody's going to be fitting through. And I love it that that's when the journalist breaks, right? Like that's her breaking point. Cause she's close, but can't get there kind of thing. And that man, when she collapses and starts freaking, you know, again, we've seen this before. This is the Blair Witch model. This is her in the tent. I would tell my mom.
But like, that is exactly what would happen to a lot of people. You know, you reach a certain point where you just kind of fall apart. You keep it together as long as you can. And then you hit your limit. I like it.
And very smartly, the filmmakers with these interview scenes, which now as the film is beginning to move into its, you know, final act, you know, now if you didn't notice earlier that, you know, Rick is not amongst these three.
Yeah, there's no Pete. There's no Tangles.
No Pete.
They don't make it.
Right. Like, you know, now that this isn't going to end well. Tangles is gone. So now that's been confirmed. And so they, you know, but here's where they make the choice. Like, okay, we're out. Like, we're gone. We're going to try and retrace our steps. We're going to get out of here as quickly as we can. And you know, the equipment is starting to get faulty. They're losing battery, so they're not going to have light. Like, there's a real ramp up of the tension in the film. And I feel like the filmmakers really, really, I think they really take advantage of, right? Like, the panic that everybody's feeling feels natural. It doesn't feel forced. It feels like, okay, it makes a ton of sense that now they've reached this point. They've just got to get out. And you know, we get this nice interlude. They keep finding stuff. You know, they're seeing more and more evidence of, you know, something down there, something moving around them. And then what is it? It's the subway guy from earlier, right? He shows up.
Yeah.
Again, and he's kind of like down in the tunnels, and he finds him, and he's like, "Oh, I'll get you guys out." But you know, spoiler alert, he doesn't. But like, I do so love to, the night vision camera gets busted, so it's even, you know, you still can't see anything. But like, I guess the big sort of final climactic bit of this is they wind up down in one of these tunnels flooded with this water, right? The water that they were going to extract to deal with this problem. And in the water is something, right? Something big and something that likes to eat people.
And we still don't know what it is. And you're not going to find out what it is.
Nope. It's just big and it's intimidating and it's big enough to sort of dominate a human being. And I guess we see it eating through someone's skull. It looks like it's like eating its head.
Yeah.
In the water. And again, you know, I'm overselling it. You really don't see much of anything, which is great. But there's definitely the insinuation that they are like in the water with this thing. And it is in the process of consuming the subway guy or someone. I think it was a subway guy, but maybe not. It was another homeless guy. But yeah, like, so it's this creature, and they're terrified and they're in this water. There's nowhere they can go. The camera equipment is basically borked. You know, they can't see anything. They don't know what they're doing. And it's really good. Again, it evoked a lot of the original Blair Witch for me, just that desperation, that sense that, you know, what are we going to do? How can we fight this? How can we escape this? And ultimately, you know, it's just the classic. We got to keep going. We're going to retrace.
Yeah, we just got to fucking run for it.
We just got to run. Like, there's no option here. And so like, it really, again, they're playing with the conceit of the interviews, but like literally Pete makes it until the very end.
Like, I really thought it was going to yeah. pull one on me. Like, I had so much hope. I was like, Pete's going to get out. And then maybe like the documentary would cut to like Pete in a hospital bed.
Right.
And I'd be like, well, I'll take Mike it out.
Like, yeah. Oh, and they've just been holding that from us. You know, we just haven't seen that interview yet,
but he doesn't.
But no, he gets attacked and they're literally dragging him out. We make our way back to the first like giant subway tunnel that we saw at the beginning. So we kind of know, again, you're spot on when you said that the film sort of gets smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller. And then as we get out, it goes, you know, bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. And it's a very good, you know, to use these various tunnels to sort of reinforce the way that these characters are feeling. And
I feel like As Above, So Below did something similar, but maybe a little bit poorer, because it didn't call attention to it the way that this movie does.
Right. This movie's pretty open about it, but it works because, because there, we also have the tension in the last moment. They've reached the big tunnel. They know how close they are to the surface, or at least to where they need to be. And then they make the decision to go back for Pete, who at this point is still alive. But he's messed up. And so they set the camera down and then they like run down the tunnel again. And it's a real nice, like, you know, it's just a good moment of tension in a film like this.
Yeah.
And then we get, you know, now we're back to the security camera footage, seeing them emerge. And then we make it full circle back to her making the phone call, you know, asking for help in the subway station, which is where, you know, Pete dies. And then it's kind of just like the denouement and out. You know, we find out that the journalist, you know, she left the profession. She's no longer working in that profession.
Probably for the best.
Probably for the best, you know. Steve's continued on or whatever, but you know, it's just
Sans Tangles. Very
it's
sad.
Not Steven Tangles anymore. It's a bit of a downer ending, you know, like there's no happiness here. We do know that these people survived, but I like that this film was confident enough in its storytelling that it didn't have to rely upon that fairly consistent found footage conceit of, well, they're all dead now and we don't have answers. Right.
Yeah.
I like that they didn't feel the need to sort of stick there. They're like, no, people lived. we still don't have answers. Right?
Yeah.
Like, we still don't know.
Yeah. And it does that. It does that. Like, did you ever watch that show Disappeared?
Yeah.
Where, like, it would end on, like, these family members who are like, we still don't know what happened. And then it would just be them looking really sad. And then the show would just fucking end. And yeah, like, oh, shit. It. God. You know, what am I getting myself into with a show called Disappeared? Exactly. But, you know, spoiler alert, they don't find them.
They don't find them.
They disappeared.
Yeah. It's not called Found. Found was supposed to be the follow-up, but they never found
them. It's like watching Unsolved Mysteries. I'm always fucking surprised when they don't solve that mystery. I'm like, yeah.
Yeah, the guy would come up at the end and be like, yeah, they still don't know. And it's like, well, I guess that is the name of the show, isn't it?
Bullshit.
But, you know, I a couple of, you know, the performances in this, these are definitely semi-pro actors, right? Like, these are not like huge pros. I imagine they've got good careers in Australia. Like, they definitely seem at a good level, but I just really have to praise Steve's performance in this.
Yeah.
The guy playing Steve is excellent. He kind of becomes the lead of the film. You think it's going to be the journalist, but it's really Steve.
Like, Steve's your audience.
Carries the movie.
He's your audience stand-in.
He's the audience stand-in. He's the one that's saying all the things that we would say in that situation. And, you know, I really think it's a standout performance from him.
Yeah.
And, you know, I go and look at his IMDb and, you know, he was, the thing is that he's actually a camera operator. Like, that is his job.
That's
on
fantastic.
Most things. And so I think he got this job because he could act reasonably and well enough, but he probably was actually running that camera for most of those scenes. Cause he's only acted in like three projects, but he's got, you know, several in camera and electrical, including The Real Housewives of Sydney. He's a camera operator on that show.
Good for him.
So anyway, just, I think he's great. And in general, I think all of the performances in this are pretty solid. You know, we've seen a lot of found footage at this point where the people involved in the horror just don't sell it. You know, like, they're just not, they're not there. They're not at the level of panic and desperation that you kind of need to be. Again, we've talked about the Blair Witch ad nauseum across many episodes, but the reason that works is because those directors were out there in the woods scaring the shit out of those kids.
Yeah.
On a regular basis. So when, like, the shit pops off, they're not having to act that much, if I can put it that way, right? Like, those feelings were probably pretty legitimate. Because I don't care if I know and remember, hey, I'm an actor. I'm being paid a couple $1,000s to come out here in the woods and roam around and get into some fights with people, you know, but they didn't know what was happening next. And so if it's 3 o'clock in the morning and I'm sleeping in a tent, which is already out in the woods, going to be kind of weird. And all of a sudden there's like little kid voices in the woods.
I lose my mind.
I mean, the whole conceit of I'm an actor being paid to do this, it's not what's going to hit first. You
At
know?
The same That's time, though, I down. Want somebody to offer me that job. Be like, do you mind just hanging out in the woods while we freak you out for a while and we film it?
That seems pretty cool.
And I'll be like, yeah, count me in. Please traumatize me. Yeah. It'd be great.
Traumatize me and film it. Awesome. So, I mean, you know, we've kind of walked through it now. I think the strengths of the tunnel are pretty apparent. But, you know, this, surprisingly enough, this for me is now one of my top found footage films.
Yeah.
You know, in a genre that I already like a lot of it and I'm willing to tolerate some pretty mediocre versions of it. I mean, this is definitely to the top of my list. Like, it's legitimately scary at times. I think it's anchored by solid performances. Very thoughtful camera work, and ultimately, like, a really engaging and understandable story. You know, like, again, I buy that these people would have been in this situation and had this happen to them. And that's cool. Like, a lot of found footage movies don't even bother to, you know, try and do that kind of thing. Now, again, this is available on Tubi. And I'm just going to warn you that if you watch it on Tubi is immediately going to recommend Grave Encounters for you.
Oh.
It is the number one recommendation under the You May Also Like if you go and watch The Tunnel. And if you haven't seen Grave Encounters, Grave Encounters is the faux documentary Ghost Adventures show. Like, it's supposed to be a Ghost Adventures show where it's a bunch of people who go around and just like, make up ghost shit, like, ooh, we heard a thing. And then they run around and whatever. And they go to this asylum and then it like actually happens for real. But it also came out in 2011. So the same year as The Tunnel. But it is terrible. Just the worst kind of garbage that you could possibly imagine. Terrible conceit. All of the people involved are terrible. The actors are fine. I mean, they're doing what they do. And they're supposed to be kind of slimy because they're supposed to be like cheesy TV hosts that are trying to, get people to say that they've seen ghosts even when they haven't, that kind of thing. So just, again, if you're a frequent Tubi user, just be aware that The Tunnel is good found footage, but that's going to start recommending a whole lot of bad found footage. So if you just want to see the difference, yeah. Paranormal Entity, right?
Oh,
2009's
I remember
not Paranormal Activity. Paranormal Entity.
And if there's a big difference.
There is a substantial difference between those. It's easy to clown on Oren Peli for that franchise, but then you watch the people who are trying to imitate it and you get why that movie blew up.
Yeah.
Right.
Suddenly like, Paranormal really Activity is not that bad.
Could it's be worse. Not that bad.
Could be so much worse.
So much worse. Anyway. Huge recommendation for The Tunnel. What a great flick. What a wonderful find. I found it in a list of people who are excited because it's apparently getting a Blu-ray release here in the States at some point in the near future.
I love physical media weirdos because they really do keep their eyes on all of these movies that I missed from like 12 years ago that
yeah.
never heard of from right. I mean, countries I no that I don't know much about their film industry. So, yeah. I feel like we get a lot of recommendations from people who are like, this is coming out on Blu-ray. 12 people saw this movie.
Right, exactly. I guess Umbrella Releasing is the one who's doing it. And they were the same ones who brought Babadook here. So apparently they're in like the same family of releasing. And yeah, Babadook is
popular. It's been a long time since I've seen that. I should rewatch that.
It's a tough rewatch, man. Like that mother-son relationship in that movie still is just, it's heart-wrenching. And gut-wrecking because you can feel how real it feels, like how honest it is.
I mean, it did give me one of my favorite memes of all time, the why can't you just be normal? Yeah. And you put something different over the kid's face. I have used that so many times.
It's a template for the ages. and we've discussed Jennifer Kent, in our Cabinet of Curiosities episodes. She did The Murmuring and, she just has a very adept hand at honest human relationships, real deep emotion and pain.
Making me feel things while I'm scared.
Absolutely. Another recommendation I'll throw out, I think I've recommended it before, but The Nightingale was her follow-up to The Babadook, which is a period piece in New Zealand and brutal, absolutely brutal watch. Oh my God. The things that the main character of that film goes through are just, oh my gosh, emotionally obliterating from top to bottom, but it's brilliant. It's an incredible film. Absolutely stunning. Jennifer Kent, you can't go wrong. So if The Tunnel is coming to the States with the same group that brought us The Babadook, that does say something for me of its quality. So I will definitely be hunting that down when I get a hold of it. So when I can find it, but big recommend on The Tunnel for me. How about you?
I loved it. I love found footage movies. I love spooky movies. I kind of love movies from like the 2010s era. Because I feel like a lot of good movies came out. A lot of movies came out, period, because that was, I don't know.
It was pretty boom time.
It really was, especially with horror movies like this. So I don't know. This movie was really exciting. And just talking about it kind of makes me want to watch it again, which is a strong endorsement. Usually I don't return to a lot of these movies.
No, I mean, you know, it may sound like we watch movies all the time, but it really is something you have to kind of schedule. And, you know,
it's pretty selective. But this was fantastic and I really enjoyed it. I just like a simple horror film. You know, it's not trying to do too much. It's not trying to reinvent anything. Like, this does nothing to reinvent found footage movies in any way.
No. Mm-mm. Like I said, the interspersing of the interview footage is one of the things that's a little bit different.
But I mean, that before. I have seen movies try that.
Oh, sure.
Kind of. But this, it's like it does all of the things I want to see, and it does them really, really, really well.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's just a really good example of when you take the premise of found footage, build it around a solid story that is grounded and feels real, right? Like, this could be happening. You know, that's where the Blair Witch really set itself apart, is that it was doing something supernatural, but it made it feel so real. By the end of that film, I mean, there were legitimately people at that time being like, did that really happen?
Oh, yeah.
And you know, yes, we can clown on those people for being stupid, but at the same time, the reason why they're asking that question is that the film does a great job of establishing itself. It's filmmaking technique, convincing someone that what they're seeing is actually happening. And this one is in that same ballpark for me. Like, it's doing a lot of the same things. I do have to intersperse here. I just went and looked up our buddy Tangles, whose real name is Luke Arnold. He was John Silver on Black Sails, that TV show.
Oh.
And he did 40 episodes.
Good for him.
Tangles is doing okay.
Good on you, Tangles. Made good.
Way to be. But yeah. So anyway, big recommends. A fun found footage film, which again, most of them are such garbage and such trash that it's really refreshing to sort of discover one so far after the fact that kind of snuck under our radar and ends up being, you know, a really, really solid example. So excited to sort of bring some attention to this one. Hopefully some other people will find it too. All right. So I guess let's wrap up. Where can people find you if they want to get all of your tunnel navigation tips for under the city of Sydney?
I run a spelunking blog. No, I actually have big a spelunking Twitter here. Account. I'm still on Twitter.
Nice.
At Baskinator.
Baskinator Spelunks. Yeah.
Actually, most of the time you'll find me tweeting things about Helldivers. So,
yes, I can attest to the truth of that. You can always find me at T Baskin. You can get us together at F Peace Theater, also on the website that someone tried to name X. But we'll always be known as Twitter, no matter how
my URL still says Twitter.
It does. It does. I still click Twitter and that's where it goes. So that's what I'll continue doing until Elon makes it stop. But yes, you can find us on there and you can always email us at failurepeace@gmail.com. Thanks for listening. Thanks for hanging out with us. We had some weird technical problems with this one, but hopefully it'll all splice together just okay. But we always enjoy hanging out with you guys and talking movies, especially about movies just didn't quite make it at the time, but are still maybe worth your attention. But hopefully we'll see you in the near future with another one.
Bye bye.